We're going to be speaking to you this morning about addressing contemporary atheism. But in fact, it's going to be a much larger scale talk than that. Because what happens when we come up against atheism, or even just agnosticism, really, the same phenomenon, or a similar phenomenon, of course, if you've ever gotten into a conversation with someone who advocates the atheist position or takes some kind of agnostic position, you start to get the feeling as you go along, or get the sense that you're dealing with something or you're up against something much bigger than just a commitment to a particular proposition, such as, you know, God doesn't exist, or a doubt about that proposition. And in fact, that's correct. What you're confronting when you're confronting atheism is a large-scale, deep, philosophical matrix. Okay, so the atheism is really embedded. The contemporary atheism is deeply embedded in this large-scale philosophical matrix. Okay, and what I want to do this morning is spend some time outlining the contours of this large-scale matrix. And as I do so, I think you'll start to realize, wait a second, this isn't just a particular philosophical position. This is like the world in which we live. That's right. So in a sense, when you're confronting the atheism, you're taking on the world, okay? That's why it's not that easy, or things run much deeper. And this allows you to accommodate or readjust your expectations and intentions without falling into despair. We'll get to that. And also allows you to realize, I think, the spiritual significance of the Thomistic Institute and the things that are unfolding here and your participation in it. Okay? Yesterday we started to talk about evangelization and mission and things like that. We're going to continue talking about that today. But here's how I'm going to go about laying out the contours of the world, so to speak, that we are in and going into in order to bring them around, I guess you could say. So what are we bringing them from, and what are we bringing them to, okay? I'm going to talk with you this morning about a diagnosis or a position laid out by someone named Lloyd Gerson, okay, who's written several big books. One is From Plato to Platonism, and the other is Aristotle and Other Platonists, okay? Which may sound intriguing. Because we're accustomed to pitting Aristotle and Plato against each other, and we're not wrong to do so when we're talking about very specific theses, okay? But when we're talking about larger issues, they're very much in the same camp. So Lloyd Gerson makes the claim, basically, that there's this reality in the history of philosophy called Platonism. And Platonism is this very large, not just philosophy, but really you could say movement, okay, among thinkers. Now, if you ask the question, what is Platonism, it's very difficult to answer the question, okay? But there is something that Lloyd Gerson calls Ur-Platonism. Okay? UR-Platonism. And what he says is that this Platonism, or Platonism, is a big tent that is open and includes many, many different philosophers. So according to this Ur-Platonism, or big tent Platonism, someone like Aristotle would very much be a Platonist. But so would a lot of others. So what do we mean by, or what does he mean by this Ur-Platonism, or what I call big tent Platonism? Okay, and here's the genius move that Gerson makes. He says that what defines and constitutes this big tent Platonism is five negative positions. Five negative positions. What are these negative positions? I'm going to start putting them in here's a circle, so here's the big tent, okay? The first thing that, as it were, is necessary to be inside the big tent, the first anti you need to hold is
anti-materialism.
Gerson gives nice definitions of these. Anti-materialism. It is false that the things that exist are bodies and their properties. Okay? Or just bodies and their properties. So that position is false. To say that there is just bodies and their properties, that's false. That's anti-materialism. Okay? Next comes anti-mechanicism. The mechanistic account of reality, or a purely mechanistic account of reality, is not true. Here's his way of describing it. It is false that the explanations available to a materialist are adequate for explaining reality. It's false that the explanations available to a materialist are adequate for explaining reality. I take it that to describe that more, we might say something like, to try to explain reality in terms of material causes and efficient causes alone is not sufficient. We need formal causality and final causality as well. The third anti or negative position that goes into the Big Ten Platonism is anti-nominalism. The forms are real. Things have natures. Now, whether those natures exist in particular things or beyond particular things, that's much more specific claim. But just what Plato and Aristotle are agreed in being against this position. Here's how he defines anti-nominalism. It is false that the only thing that exists are individuals, each uniquely situated in space and time. Okay? Things have natures. They either have forms or participate in the forms or something like that. There's some kind of account of universals. Natures. So it's anti-nominalist. The fourth, anti-relativism. And here we have to distinguish between two kinds of relativism, epistemological and moral. So in epistemology, this anti-relativism goes like this. It is false that the true is what appears to me, or my group, or a group. It is false that the true is what appears to me, or to my group. Okay? In ethics, anti-relativism is the view that it is false that the good is what is good for me, or for my group, or a group. Okay? Now, as I'm going through these, you might start to realize, wait a second, all of these are being contradicted left and right. Like, the world outside, okay, has lots of defenders and promoters. And the world inside this circle can feel very small, okay? And then the last thing is anti-skepticism. It is false that knowledge is impossible. That's how Gerson defines it, okay? That's pretty broad. I'm quite well aware, and we're all here aware, that you can nuance skepticism and other these positions in all kinds of ways, okay? So you can have sensory skepticism, you can have metaphysical skepticism, you can have moral skepticism, you can have religious skepticism. You can be skeptical about particular domains, or you can be skeptical in general. What characterizes the Big Ten Platonist school seems to be the view that we can arrive at certain necessary, universal, eternal, immutable truth. Okay? And anyone that denies that is going to be outside the Big Ten Platonist school. Okay? All right, so these are the five negative positions that constitute Big Ten Platonism. I put them on the border here, because outside of each of these, there's going to be the polar opposite. So nominalism is kind of running amok. things don't have natures, there's only particulars and individuals. Materialist reductionism or physicalist reductionism is all around us. Mechanistic accounts of the universe, even though that's on the ropes in various ways. Relativism is certainly a pop phenomenon among undergraduates and whatnot, but among others, I mean, as well, of course. And skepticism of its many varieties, like I outlined earlier. You can be skeptical about the possibility of knowing truth altogether, or you can be skeptical about various domains. Now, in a room like this, my sense is that there's a lot of scientists and mathematicians amongst us. And when people are in those disciplines, skepticism is generally not as much of a danger, it seems to me. But outside the sciences and outside of math, skepticism really is a danger, okay? Especially in the area of morals. A lot of people just think, we just can't know the moral truth, okay? Or they'll go there when they want to stand for a particular position, they'll give a relativistic defense, but then they'll turn around with all kinds of moral indignation about other matters, okay? So, these positions are all known in the ancient world, okay? So you have, as it were, the outside and inside the big tent, okay? Plato is aware of this, and he has a name for it. In one of his dialogues, he talks about the people inside the circle he calls the friends of the forms, okay? The friends of the forms. And outside the circle, the people are called the earthbound giants, he calls them, okay? They're earthbound giants basically because they think matter explains everything, okay? And the friends of the forms realize that these positions don't work and it's possible to know the forms. And there is a certain joy. I mean, maybe you've experienced it yourself. I don't know what it was like for you when you were first introduced to Plato, or if you made your way into philosophy through ancient philosophy, there is something compelling or appealing or attractive about Plato at first, okay? He says, look, there is truth. And there's eternal truth. And you want to know it, don't you? And wouldn't it be awesome to know it? Well, because wouldn't that satisfy? It'd be beautiful to see the array of the essences of things. And guess what? You can. You can know this. And you can be profoundly satisfied. And you can become a good person, and you can be shaped and formed into someone beautiful yourself, precisely by contemplation of the forms and the natures of things. That's the, you could say, the original inspiration of philosophy. And when philosophy is introduced that way to people, it's compelling, it's captivating. There's something evangelical about it. There's good news there. It's of the natural order, but it's still good. It's very attractive and very compelling. But oftentimes what happens when people actually study philosophy in the contemporary context is you end up getting, that's dismissed. And what you do is you get an introduction into like earthbound giant thinking. Okay? All right? I'm going to say a couple more things now about Big Ten Platonism as the way Gerson describes it. Big Tent Platonism, or one of the kernel core principles of it, Big Tent Platonism holds that real explanation is top-down and never bottom-up. The atoms don't explain it. It's not the stuff out of which things are made that explains it. Bottom-up explanation doesn't do it. It's always top-down, either from the form of the thing or from a higher principle, such as God. And in the true explanatory framework, the many are explained in terms of the smallest number of principles. Okay, the many are explained in terms of the smallest number of principles. The complex is explained in terms of the simple. The many are explained in terms of the one. That's why an atomism that posits an infinite number of irreducible entities roving by chance. That contradicts one of the basic principles, explanatory principles of Big Tent Platonism. So in all of these, inside the Big Ten, among the friends of the forums, there's always going to be at the center a principle, a single principle, the one, if you're a Plotinus, God, the unmoved mover, the good. There's going to be one that explains everything in the world.
Okay.
That's one of the features. Now, Gerson then asked the question, is it possible to take all five of these negative positions and sort of synthesize or summarize them in one? And he says, yes. He says, really, this Big Tent Platonism or Ur-Platonism or the friend of the forms position is really a comprehensive anti-naturalism. Comprehensive anti-naturalism. So if you notice, what's outside the circle is really a kind of naturalistic picture, starting with materialism and mechanicism, or mechanistic thought, combined in some way with nominalism. That's basically the mechanistic, naturalistic worldview, or physicalist reductionism. Okay? And that's sort of how he describes it. And then basically the way he understands it is that this large tent or big tent school, the Friends of the Forms or Platonism, is really a movement in the history of philosophy beginning with Socrates and Plato, okay? And it is more or less, how should I put it, successful or flourishing at different times and in places down through history. At certain times and places, it has become extremely culturally influential. And at other times, its cultural presence and influence diminishes and, it just diminishes and loses that influence. So there'd be a certain period in the first, say, 4 centuries AD where this Big Tent Platonism is flourishing. It's very culturally influential, both among pagans and among Christians. Then there's other times, and we could say like basically the last couple of centuries, where its advocates and its influence have shrunk and shrunk and shrunk and shrunk and shrunk. So now it seems to be just a few. Okay, and it seems to be this radically minority kind of weird position off to the side. But then what will happen is, it as time goes on, it regains a certain measure of influence. The way that Plato thinks about it is that the world in which we live will always be divided into the camps inside and outside of the circle. And that's just the way the world fundamentally is. Now, the Christians will have another story about that, about eschatology and the way, in the end, it will be resolved and the final judgment and whatnot. But that does describe our contemporary situation. Okay? When you are going up against contemporary atheism, you're not just going up against the proposition that God exists. You're going up against the whole matrix of thought outside the circle. You're going up against all these isms. Because what's behind the atheism, or what's used to justify it, is the whole web of principles and thoughts and movements outside the circle. And really, for someone to come around to theism is not just to come around to a new proposition and to flip, you know, from the proposition God doesn't exist to God does exist. It's not that. It's to make a movement, a life movement, to a change within the person where you go from outside to inside. I really think that's the way to understand it, okay? So there's really, when addressing contemporary atheism, it's really a call or a summons to someone, not just to flip on a particular proposition, but to make a fundamental radical change in their whole philosophical outlook, methodology, etc. Okay? Now, in this large-scale movement in the history of philosophy, there's many major figures inside this big tent. Obviously, you have Plato. I mean, Gerson really does ask the question, was Plato a Platonist, okay, in his way of defining it. You have Plato. You've got Aristotle. Boethius. Augustine. Bonaventure. Aquinas. Okay? Now, in the 20th century, there's going to be a good number of Big Ten Platonists. I think the early Edmund Husserl realizes there's problems with the rise of scientism, and he wants to push back against it. And he tries to do so. I would place him, the early Husserl, in the Big Ten Platonist school. And also several of his students, Dietrich von Hildebrand, Edith Stein. Now notice these people aren't Thomists, or they're not like flag-carrying Thomists, but they're still inside the big tent, you see. They're friends of the forms. And I want you to start to think, we're allies, okay? Thomas Aquinas then would be one figure among others in this big tent. Other contemporary big tent Platonists, Ratzinger, Karol Wojtyła, Robert Sokolowski over at Catholic U. He's not a Thomist per se, but very much a friend of the forms and holds all five of these negative positions and advocates for these positions very strongly. Okay, I want to float this suggestion or maybe ask the question, is Jordan Peterson a Big Ten Platonist? I think he is. And I think that's why he gets such intense pushback. Because he's a rhetorically credible Big Ten Platonist who seems to be exercising influence on a large scale. And hence, the pushback from the outside. Okay? I think you could go through each. Is he a materialist? I don't think so. Is he a nominalist? No. He said things have natures. This is what's getting him in trouble, right? There's nature. Is he give himself over to mechanistic thinking? No, he acknowledges that there's material conditions at play in the human psychological constitution, but he's not trying to reduce everything to mechanistic cause. He believes very much in free will, it seems. Is he a relativist? No way, right? That's what he's pushing back against. Here's principles, right? And then skeptic? No. So I think he's inside the Big Ten. That's one of the things that's causing the difficulties, right? Because the tent, that means the big tent that historically was shrinking. Now all of a sudden all these people are listening and the big tent starts to exercise some influence again. Okay, and people are making their way in. Thomism, or St. Thomas Aquinas and Thomism is something within this school of thought, okay, within the big tent, but we should be careful ourselves not to identify Thomas Aquinas or Thomism with Big Ten Platonism. Thomism is not the only way to hold these five positions. How do we understand these figures? Plato, Aristotle, the Stoics, Boethius, Augustine, Bonaventure, Aquinas, Dietrich von Hildebrand, Husserl. Here's how you can understand them. Once a person kind of comes over to the five anti-positions, okay, and realizes materialism, a materialist, mechanistic, nominalistic account of the world just doesn't work. Once a person comes over to that, what you need then is a positive account. Or maybe a positive account is needed to come over to it to begin with. Okay? But there is also, in addition to these anti-positions, there's also the project of positively elaborating what is the truth about reality. What is the first principle that explains it all? How do we know the first principle that explains it all? Is it possible to have something more than just knowledge of this first principle? Can we enter into personal union or spiritual union with the first principle? Both Neoplatonists and Christians say yes, but have very different answers as to how to do that. Christians say faith is necessary to enter into that union with the first principle. Neoplatonists say, no, you don't need faith, you just need Socratic dialectic. So there's disputes about things inside the Big Ten Platonist school, but what they're all trying to do is elaborate a logos, to give a reason that accounts for these five negative positions, okay, over and against the friends, over and against the earthbound giants, okay? And there are different ways of proceeding in doing that. So the way that I understand this, I've started to understand this more and more in terms of what Augustine says at the end of his book, the Contra Academicos. He takes on skepticism. which he was familiar with in his own day. There's always been skeptics down through history. He takes on skepticism. And at the end of his book, The Contra Academicos, he says there is a perennial philosophy. That's a good expression, Dad. Perennial philosophy. We've got to draw some distinctions about that. But, because Aldous Huxley wrote a book famously called Perennial Philosophy, and it's not the Big Ten Platonism, okay? But what Augustine says at the end of the Contra Academicos is that there is a true philosophy. And he says it's been elaborated by the Platonists. They've come closest to it. But what Augustine realizes is it's not correct or it's not accurate to say there's this guy's philosophy, right? There's Aristotle's philosophy, there's Plato's philosophy, there's this guy's philosophy, there's that guy's philosophy. Philosophy, if it really is capable of truth, is not going to elaborate this guy's opinion or this guy's opinion, this perspective or that perspective. Truth is one. And if philosophy is capable of the truth, there's got to be one true philosophy. He just thinks that the people who have elaborated it the most up until that point were the Platonists. I think you could understand Platonism as he's using it there in this Big Ten way. Okay? And there was someone else who was quite fond of making this point. It was Ralph McInerney, one of the prominent Thomists of the latter half of the 20th century, taught at Notre Dame for many years. He used to insist a lot, don't talk about Thomistic philosophy, Aristotelian philosophy, this kind of philosophy or that kind of philosophy, because that takes philosophy itself and places it within this perspectival kind of relativist, subjective matrix of thought. There's just truth. And the truth is what it is. And different people see it in different ways and to different degrees and have elaborated it in different ways and in different degrees. So I think of these figures, Plato, Aristotle, this Boethius, Augustine, Bonaventure, Aquinas, Husserl, Dietrich von Hildebrand, Ratzinger, Wojtyła, Sokolowski, and now maybe to some extent Jordan Peterson, just to use him as a kind of pop example. They're witnesses to the perennial philosophy. They're witnesses to the perennial philosophy. And I take it that Thomas Aquinas is the premier or primary witness to the perennial philosophy. Why is he the premier or primary witness to the perennial philosophy? Precisely because he summarizes and synthesizes or brings together in one architectonic whole 1,000 years and more of previous witnesses of the perennial philosophy. That's the greatness of Thomas. And that's why he is, I think, basically a permanent monument or a permanent witness to the perennial truth about God, the human race, and the world in which we live. Okay? So notice I'm asserting, and I think the church asserts, there is this perennial philosophy. Okay? It is a set of eternal, necessary, immutable truths that are what they are. It's the truth of the forms, the truth of the essences of things, the natures of things. And it's the truth about what's good and evil, right and wrong, what's just and unjust. The truth about the goal of human life, the truth about virtue, the truth about nature, all of it. And what we're involved in primarily, I think, is trying to elaborate the perennial philosophy, okay, to try to articulate it and to bear witness to the truth of it in our times. Okay? One last point, and this is about theology in particular. There's a lot of crazy theology out there. There's a lot of crazy biblical exegesis out there. Why? What's the problem? All of the fathers of the church were Big Ten Platonists. Okay? And they read the scriptures quite consciously, bringing that philosophy to bear on the scriptures. And they read the scriptures on the basis of the presuppositions of the big tent Platonism, or on the basis of the perennial philosophy. And it's only on the basis of the principles of this philosophy that you can read scripture the way they did, and it can make sense, where you have not only the literal sense, but the spiritual sense and the various kinds of spiritual senses, right? Allegorical senses, moral senses. That makes sense inside the perennial philosophy when you're bringing perennial philosophy to bear on the text and reading it as a philosopher in that sense. But as soon as you step outside of this circle and be out and step out here and then try to read the scriptures, it doesn't make any sense. What do you have to do? You have to explain away the miracles, explain away the exorcisms, explain away the prophecies, try to situate the text. They're not really saying that Jesus is God. All you have to do, all that stuff. And that's, I think, where things are at in theology and in scriptural exegesis. A great deal of contemporary theology, what they call theology or scriptural exegesis, is really working out the theological implications of bringing this other philosophy, if you can even call it that, to bear on the texts. Okay? Here's some things to think about. Contemporary scientism and physicalistic reductionism, they hold what? They hold materialism, mechanicism, and nominalism. Okay? Or at least mechanicism and materialism. If a person holds those two or three positions, can you hold those two or three positions without going all the way to relativism and skepticism? Okay? Is it possible to hold one, two, and three without going to four and five? That's the big question. Okay? I want to suggest to you that a great deal of modern philosophy, especially early modern philosophy, is precisely that. It's the attempt to hold materialism, mechanicism, and nominalism, but not bite the bullet and go all the way over to relativism and skepticism. So Kant is extremely skeptical about the metaphysics of things, okay, but doesn't want to be a relativist. And you've got Jeremy Bentham and John Stuart Mill. I think they are some kind of nominalists, but they don't want to go quite over to full-scale relativism. They still want to have some kind of reason for ethical judgments and whatnot. Okay? But I think the case can be made that if you hold materialism, nominalism, and mechanicism, you basically are going to end up in deep relativism and skepticism, if you're consistent, if you're consistent. Okay? Here's what another kind of theological observation. The combination of materialism, mechanicism, nominalism, relativism, and skepticism, the combination of all five of those, is what St. Paul calls the wisdom of the world. The wisdom of the world. He calls it the wisdom of the world in 1 Corinthians chapter 3, verse 19. And he's quite well aware that he and we, Christians and the church, are pushing back against this wisdom of the world. And in light of the wisdom of the world, we look stupid. He's very conscious of that. And he almost begins to revel in it, okay, and kind of enjoy it, right? Almost like the thrill of being the underdog who knows that the victory is his, okay? In Colossians chapter 2, verse 8, he calls it philosophy according to the stoicheia tou kosmou. Okay? How do you translate stoicheia? A lot of the translations will say according to the elemental spirits of the universe. But translators try to figure out, what does he mean by that? Does he mean a philosophy based on, like, such that all you're doing is asserting, what you're doing is saying all there is the material entities and the forces of nature, and that's it, and that's your philosophy? That could be one interpretation of philosophy according to the elements of the cosmos. There's natural entities, there's forces, and that's it? Or is he saying that there's these elemental forces, like spirits, like demons, and a lot of the philosophy is actually like their manifestation and activity in the world? It's ambiguous, and it can be understood in both senses. In other words, this wisdom of the world is not just the wisdom of human beings. It is that. It's like the thinking of human beings in collaboration with dark powers, okay, who are anti-Christ, ultimately, okay? And at the center for St. Paul and St. John, at the center of this perennial philosophy, you have God, or Logos. In the beginning is the Word. Okay, that's the first principle, Logos. And Ratzinger's way of being a perennial thinker inside of this big tent is to have a kind of Logos theology. Okay. I want you to kind of be aware then of what we might call the theological significance of this. This is not just a philosophical issue. There are theological and spiritual dimensions of this, where the fight between perennial philosophy and those against the perennial philosophy has this kind of cosmological battle kind of dimension to it. Okay? If you want to see an elaboration of the wisdom of the world in the scriptures, go to the Book of Wisdom, chapter 2. In the Book of Wisdom, chapter 2, you'll see articulated the wisdom of the... You'll see the materialism, you'll see the hedonism, the relativism, the skepticism, all of that. And then in the Book of Wisdom, chapter 2, it basically asserts that it's this wisdom that's responsible for the persecution of the one who claims to be a son of God. Okay? Okay. So I wanted to lay this whole thing out because I think this gives you a map of all the issues, all the major issues you're going to run into, okay, one way or another. I mean, as soon as we started to have our first conversations yesterday and our first Q&A periods, what were people raising? They were raising questions. Well, how are you going to deal with skepticism? And how are you going to deal with this problem in a mechanistic, materialistic thought? It's like the dominant thing that we're born into and raised in is outside, and we're accustomed to these modes of thought. And trying to make our way into this is a challenge. And if it's a challenge for us, who are disposed to it, how much more challenging is it going to be for those we speak to who aren't accustomed to, even don't even have the first awareness of what's inside the circle, okay, of the perennial philosophy? So when we go to argue against atheism or try to win people over, we should not be surprised that it's difficult. We should not be surprised that it's a long-term process. We should not expect our arguments, principles, and reasons to be immediately evident to people that we present them to. Okay? It's going to take a transitional process, a metanoia, a conversion, a transformation to go from the outside in. But what we're involved in is precisely that, pushing back against what's outside and inviting people in to the big tent. So let's talk about that. Let's talk about ways we could do that. I'm going to give a simple argument, I could say, for big tent Platonism or for the perennial philosophy, and then I'll give you something a little bit more sophisticated, I think. So let's start with a simple argument against the wisdom of the world, okay? Here's the argument. It is irrational to affirm a position that contradicts many profound intuitions about ourselves without a good reason for doing so. I'll say that again. It is irrational to affirm a position that contradicts many profound intuitions about ourselves without a good reason for doing so. Okay? Everyone has intuitions, deep intuitions, profound intuitions. Okay, it's the sort of the seeds of truth within us. And philosophers, in their argumentation, always appeal to those intuitions. and we use those intuitions to adjudicate philosophical positions. Okay? So, for example, if a philosophical position were, if a position in ethics, for example, were to entail that it's okay, it's morally acceptable to torture an infant, we'd say, wait a second, there's something wrong with this position. Okay? It has this profoundly counterintuitive implication. And we do the same thing in metaphysics. If a position in metaphysics were to entail, for example, nothing changes, like the Parmenidean kind of thing, you'd say, wait a second, I had this really, 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 really deep intuition. Things change. Okay? So if a position entails that's just false, there's a problem with that position. Okay? It's irrational to affirm a position that contradicts many profound intuitions about ourselves without a good reason for doing so. But the wisdom of the world, or the earthbound giant stuff, or these five positions outside the circle, that philosophy implies many, many things contrary to the most profound intuitions that we have about ourselves. For example, human persons exist and are irreducible to impersonal stuff. The personal is not the impersonal. And if, or it's when they start to realize you're trying to reduce the personal to the impersonal, well, I mean, I guess what that really means is the persons don't exist. That's eliminative materialism. That's the ultimate implication. And the eliminative materialists, I think, are right to say, you just aren't willing to bite the bullet of the full implications of your materialism. Human persons exist and are irreducible to impersonal stuff. Here's another intuition. As human persons, we are free agents. That's very hard to see if a mechanistic account of the world is true. Seems impossible. We are free agents. We are capable of knowing moral truths. For example, do no harm, do no injustice, etc. Other intuitions. Human beings have intrinsic dignity and worth. That's always a good principle to start with if you come up against a relativist. Do you believe that human beings have intrinsic dignity and worth? Can we agree on that? Okay, is that just true for you? Is that just true for us? Or is that just simply true? Those are good questions to ask right up front. We are morally responsible for our free choices. That's why there's trials and punishments and crimes and why we think that's fair. If we're not free agents, if we're not morally responsible, if we don't have moral knowledge, then criminal trials and sentencings are essentially unfair and unjust. Some acts are objectively and inherently evil, such as child abuse and the Holocaust. In a certain sense, I've heard it said that Jordan Peterson's whole project kind of begins like this. The Holocaust was objectively evil. Therefore, there's a transcendent criterion of good and evil. Now let's go from there. That's a pretty good argument. There's a self-transcendent meaning of life, meaning an objective meaning prior to and independently of our wishes and whims, which is given to us. There's a self-transcendent meaning of life. That's why human beings ask the question, what's the meaning of life? And it is reasonable to seek God, to believe in him, and to worship him according to his revelation to us. I think what's happened is we've gotten really accustomed to the idea that atheism is normal. In fact, if you take the large picture of human history, human society, atheism is a radically small minority. It's like an aberration. It's an anomaly. Always, or for the most part, human beings believe in God or some kind of first principle, higher power, something. And they carry out religious acts, like to try to worship him and thank him. Human beings are naturally religious. It's only if you live in 21st century North America and Western Europe that you could start to get the impression maybe we're not essentially religious. But it's important for us to realize that's an anomaly in the big picture of things, and to remember that, okay? In other words, the wisdom of the world requires us to contradict or give up on our most profound intuitions. But there's no good reason to deny these intuitions, given the ongoing project of Big Ten Platonism. You don't have to bite the bullet on all those intuitions. You don't have to yield to despair. You don't have to yield to live in contradiction to your own most profound intuitions and inclinations. There's another way of living and looking at things besides the Sapientia Mundi. And I take it that that's our basic mission. Our basic mission is just to let people know you don't have to succumb to all the, you could say, the dark implications of the wisdom of the world or earthbound giant thinking. You don't have to. Just to let people know they don't have to go there, that's already a huge step. Okay? Because I think for a lot of people, they just think, well, that's just what you have to do. Now, some people really want to go there. They want to flee or run from this. Some people involuntarily flee, okay, from the first principle of all things, from God. But other people aren't necessarily voluntarily fleeing from him. They just can't see their way to him. There's lots of roadblocks or obstacles in the path that need to be cleared out. And to let them know there's another way, there's an alternative way. That's a huge gift to give them, okay? I will now ask another question, the last question I'll ask, and then we can go into Q&A. Is there a way into the big tent? What's the way in? Okay? And sometimes philosophers ask that, phenomenologists ask that. What's the way into the practice of this thing called phenomenology? Here's a way in that we can provide people. It's a way that worked in my own life, and I've seen it work in the lives of other people as well. And it comes from a thinker, Alasdair MacIntyre, especially in his book called Three Rival Versions of Moral Inquiry. Okay? Three Rival Versions of Moral Inquiry. And in that text, he does something profound. He goes through, in a sense, the history of philosophy and gives you a big picture, the whole history of philosophy. And he makes a powerful claim, okay, that strikes right at the heart of a lot of the questions. If we take the statement that man is a rational animal as our starting point, we can ask the question, what do you mean by rational? What do you mean by rational? Okay. And what MacIntyre says is that the history of philosophy has given us three basic accounts of what rationality is. He calls it rationality or moral inquiry. There's three basic accounts of what rationality is. Now, let's notice, this is not a metaphysical position. He's not trying to give a metaphysical argument, okay? It's more anthropological, in a sense. It's about us. But there's three understandings of rationality. The first one he calls the Augustinian Thomistic conception of rationality. The Augustinian Thomistic conception of rationality. On this conception of rationality, reason is developmental. Reason is developmental, which strikes us as pretty evident right up front. People aren't born fully rational. I mean, they're not born with their reason or cognition perfected. Our reason develops and grows over time from the time of our youth into our adulthood, and even in our adulthood, it continues to develop. So reason is developmental, and there are certain preconditions for the possibility of the full development of one's rationality. There are certain things a person needs to do in order for his or her reason to develop or grow strong or be perfected. And among the conditions that need to be fulfilled in order for a person's reason to develop fully is an act of entrusting oneself to a teacher in a tradition of inquiry. We need to entrust ourselves to teachers in a tradition of inquiry. Okay? This is what Augustine learns in his own conversion experience. The need for faith, okay, at the root of rational inquiry. Okay? That's the Augustinian Thomistic understanding of rationality. So on this understanding of rationality, faith makes perfect sense. It's actually one of the things we need to do in order to be rational. Okay? That's the Augustinian Thomistic understanding. And it's not just that you entrust yourself to teachers for the sake of faith in the scriptures, but also in order, there's an act of faith that goes into the process of philosophical learning as well. Okay? So in order to make your way from your starting point and experience to the first principles and to see them clearly, you need to make an act of faith in these philosophical teachers and in this philosophical tradition, the tradition of the perennial philosophy. That's the Augustinian Thomistic account of rationality. The second account he calls the Enlightenment account of rationality. On the Enlightenment account of rationality, reason consists of, or reason basically steps out of all tradition, steps out of pre-commitments, and tries to get to a neutral, presuppositionless point of view in order to adjudicate all points of view from this neutral perspective. Okay? You can think of Descartes and his methodic doubt, stepping out of all previous philosophers and philosophies, or trying to step out of all that and adopt this point of view of pure reason that's neutral and presuppositionless, and start the process of knowledge all over again from this point of view. This has two implications. Number one, it denies that reason is developmental. Okay? But also, what it does is it effectively starts a new tradition. So what happens is that the Enlightenment conception of rationality starts out with, we're going to throw off the tradition and start over from this purely critical point of view, but in effect develops a tradition. So now what is happening is people are, without realizing it, being initiated into a tradition of inquiry, a tradition of rationality, and they're entrusting themselves to it. But it's a tradition of inquiry that tells you you should not entrust yourself to people and to teachers and to traditions. You should not be an apprentice of past masters. But in fact, it's now become a tradition with its own past masters, its own texts, its own canonical ways of proceeding, its own internal methodologies. And what happens is there's a fundamental contradiction or incoherence within it. Okay? It's a tradition that tells you, don't do tradition. Okay? Given the failures of the Enlightenment conception of rationality, what flows out of that, and there are many other failures of it and problems with it that McIntyre lists, what flows out of that is the third conception of rationality, the genealogical conception of rationality. Okay? The genealogical conception is articulated by the masters of suspicion, Marx and Nietzsche. He takes Nietzsche as the critical figure. On this view, reason is a mask for the will to power. Reason is a mask for the will to power. Okay? Truth claims are really assertions of the will to power. What we need to do in our rational life, so to speak, is learn to unmask the claims, the truth claims that are made, and to surface the more sinister motives that are behind them, and the more fundamental hidden motives, hidden intentions, or hidden explanations for why people say what they say. Okay? This is what's called the hermeneutics of suspicion. Okay? And you'll run into the hermeneutics of suspicion anytime you come up against any of the isms of the day. Feminism, it just goes on and on, okay? What we basically need to do is unmask the will to power hidden behind all truth claims, okay? Now, what McIntyre did for me when I first read him, when I was an undergraduate, at the end of my undergraduate studies, is he gave me the lay of the land. He helped me realize why the contemporary university in which I was living and studying was an incoherent morass, okay? Was an incoherent morass of, like, unintelligible, like, just positions here, there, and everywhere, okay? And he was able to lead me into the big tent without going through the metaphysics. And here's how you do it. You just go like this. Do you want to be rational? Sure. I'm a rational animal. That's what I want to be. Okay. Now there's three ways you can go about it. You can proceed by the Augustinian Thomistic route. You can proceed by the Enlightenment route. Or you can go genealogical. Those are the three ways you can go. If you want to come up with a fourth one, try. I mean, scientism, it seems, is a kind of enlightenment thing that's still alive in departments of science and math, but outside those departments, in other disciplines, it's genealogy all the way. Okay? What's the way you're going to go in terms of living your rational life? You can try to do the Enlightenment thing, but that's incoherent, because whether you want to or not, you're an embodied person in a tradition and you've got your canonical texts and your teachers, okay? I saw this really clearly. I mean, just the very first set of questions that people were raising in the first talks, I was like, wow, we're all very profoundly conditioned and habituated by the science education we receive when we're in, like, seventh grade. Starting in seventh grade, and it just gets deeper and deeper the more you go into it. Okay, there is this kind of neutral, disembodied observer perspective, pure observer perspective. It's not there. There's no such thing. Okay, or you can go enlightenment, or you can go genealogical. What you have is you can see the trilemma kind of approach. The Enlightenment approach does not work. And the genealogical approach does not work and won't make you happy. So guess what? There's good news. There's perennial philosophy. And there's a way in. Come and trust yourself to the teachers and the texts of this great tradition, and your reason will gradually and slowly be purified of confusion and error, and illuminated not by one person's point of view or one teacher, but by truth itself. This is the only tradition that can make sense of that very possibility. Okay? So that's a way in to provide people. I recommend looking into McIntyre and his approach. Now, I've given you what we might call a kind of soft or version of McIntyre, and he makes bigger claims that are more controversial that I'm not going to go into about incommensurate, you know, paradigms and discourse, and those are much bigger claims. I'm not making that. But there is a rhetorical strategy there that works. Okay, it worked with me. I've seen it work with other people. Okay, so the three conceptions of rationality can provide a kind of way in to the perennial philosophy. All right, so we'll quit there, and then we'll open it up to Q&A.
Very quick question. So you mentioned Edmund Husserl and a few of the students in the room side.
Is it early?
I just kind of have to ask, Okay. Where is his most famous student, Heidegger? Like, I'm trying to figure out where he'll be.
No, he would not be in this. No, I don't think so. No, I think he would. He thinks that he's got his own reading of the history of philosophy that's very different, where he thinks it's all, he's got the whole thing about the forgetfulness of being. I don't think he'd be in the Big Ten. Okay? If you want to make a case that he is, I'd be happy to hear it.
I'm not sure if this falls under one of these, but do you think it's possible there's sort of sort of a fourth, like a post-irrationality that's emerging, which might be like the evolutionary model, right? That like all of our claims about the world are just sort of the things that gave us the most advantage for surviving. It just seems to be like becoming very savage.
I think it's another, that's going to be another form of the genealogical. So we're not Capax Veritatis on that account. We're not capable of truth. I think that's the critical thing. Two of these three, the Enlightenment view thinks we are capable of truth. It's a question of method, how to get there, or how to receive it. Whereas I think the genealogical approaches think we're not capable of truth. And I think from the little that I know about what you're telling me, that way of proceeding or thinking about rationality, yeah, reason is not really a truth-responsive faculty or power or capacity. It's a survival mechanism, not a truth-responsive one. Yeah.
Those are short questions. Let's take one more.
Okay. Sure.
So I think when McIntyre is talking about the different traditions, when he talks about genealogy, I mean, he talks about some of the problems that you can kind of see emerging.
Yep.
But I don't know that he kind of leaves the door open that, like, the final kind of word hasn't been written against genealogy. In other words, like, this tradition sort of needs some more time to work itself out and see that it's just not going to be able to solve the problems.
Yeah.
But he doesn't, he kind of allows that it maybe hasn't had enough time to, like, make that attempt. And so,
not only that, he borrows some of its strategies.
Yeah, and so I guess I'm kind of wondering, like, how can we help people maybe who might be in that sort of genealogical mode, which in some ways I think is some of the most, like, you know, kind of like, you know, anti-Christian sort of ways of thinking, to kind of, like, maybe see, like, the inconsistency or the inherent error. Like, how do you kind of see people, like, moving out of that, you know, mode? So it seems like a little bit harder one if you're doing the trilemma thing to actually cross off the list.
Unless,
so I'm just wondering if you can say more about it.
Except I think that the genealogical one tends towards personal darkness and despair maybe more quickly. And so the promise or the offer of, like, a life, new life, could actually be more attractive. But what I typically do is, really, it's almost so simple. Use the most fundamental philosophical truths, right? The principle of non-contradiction. There is truth. And the incoherence that's involved in denying those. Those simple old perennial truths have a way of exploding kind of the genealogical thing. And it breaks open this, oh, wait a second, there is truth. There is, and we can know it. And these few examples show that and verify it. That often works. Now, sometimes you'll get voluntary resistance to that, okay? But pushing back against the principle of non-contradiction almost always, it just never works. So you can go for that. In fact, Thomas Joseph White has an incredible story from his own life about his days at Brown University. He was an undergrad. He was swimming in all this stuff, okay? Meaning it was the whole environment, the whole atmosphere was all this genealogical stuff. And one day it was Martha Nussbaum put the principle of non-contradiction on. There was a course on Aristotle, put the principle of non-contradiction on the board. And he just saw it. And he just realized, if the principle of non-contradiction is true, all this other stuff just can't be right. And that was really the beginning of, like, it was a huge step for him. So just going back to give them some experience of absolute truth. Give them an experience of it. Like, here's the principle of non-contradiction. Here's the statement, there is truth. It's not trivial, it's not just analytic, it's a substantive assertion about reality. And it cannot be denied. That can be an aid or a remedy.
Thank you, Father James.